It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It's been just over 10 months since President Trump took office. We'll take a look back. Welcome to Delmarva Day. This is Don Rush. President Trump's approval ratings are at their lowest in his tenure in the White House. CNN poll found that just 36% of Americans approve of how he's handling his job. Disapproval rate is at 58%. And these figures come amidst a tumultuous first year. Take a look at this year in review. In our studio this morning is Mike Pradley with the Democratic Club and Mark Edley. He is with the Wacomo County Republican Central Committee. Oh, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So, Mark, I'm going to turn to you first, sure. Since it's your guy in the White House. How do you make an assessment? As a matter of fact, I was trying to sort of write an introduction, and I was trying to find good things to say. Yeah. I mean, because there's been a lot of controversy. Yeah. How do you see it?
In terms of policy, mm-hmm. It's been a slam dunk. I think it's been a fantastic year. Whether you talk about sort of movement on border security, the economy, increasing jobs, decreasing taxation, rolling back harmful job-killing regulation – across the board, it's been, I think, a very good year. The Dow is up 30%. It was 18,000 when he took office. We now just crossed 24,000. That's a tremendous amount of capital into the economy, growing businesses, growing jobs, which will lead to more and higher paying jobs for Americans. So, whether it's, again, whether it's the economics, border security, or building back up our nation's defense that had been allowed to languish under the previous 8 years, across the board, it's been a policy success. On a personal level, there are a lot of people that don't like this president, and I think that's one of his major challenges. You mentioned his disapproval ratings. I think what Democrats can't get past is Donald Trump the man. They can't even look at Donald Trump the president. This guy could cure cancer, and the Democrats would still find fault with him. So that's what he's up against in terms of public perception, and I don't agree, certainly, with everything, the way he conducts himself, the early morning tweets and the pettiness of some of his reactions to some of the situations he finds himself in. I don't agree and condone a lot of what he's doing sort of on a personal level. I wish he would sort of elevate his conduct and sort of, to be more sort of fitting with what we expect with a president, the leader of the free world and the president of the United States. But Donald Trump's Donald Trump, and Dave Bosty and Corey Lewandowski just released a book, Let Trump Be Trump. And that's Trump being Trump. And I understand why a lot of people find that distasteful. But for those of us who can separate Trump the man and some of the personal decisions he makes about his communications with his policy decisions, I think it's been a tremendous success in terms of policy this year. And I look forward to what's coming next.
Mike Pradley, I want to turn to you. And just note, by the way, we did have the unemployment figures that came out today. Economy added about 238,000 jobs, and unemployment rate remains steady, which is, of course, always seasonally adjusted. So what's your assessment of the first 10 months?
Well, the Republicans have said that the reason they need this tax bill, which nobody has read and which they don't know what's going to be in it yet, is because there haven't been any other victories at all in the year that he's been in office. He's made all sorts of promises and all sorts of statements about what he was going to do on various issues. He was going to drain the swamp. He was going to clean up things. But there has been very little, if any, legislative activity that has been favorable to advance his agenda. There certainly has been a lot of regulatory stuff, from my perspective, most of it quite negative on the environment and on things supporting urban housing, transportation, infrastructure, which he talked about was going to be done right out of the box. And we haven't seen even a program. I think I read a lot of stuff. I don't think I've even seen a discussion of a program that was going to do all the things he said he was going to accomplish the first day in office, repealing the Affordable Care Act. None of them have come to fruition. So I don't know what world my friend Dr. Edley lives in, but he's taking credit for all sorts of victories that seem to me to be either defeats or we'll get back to you later on that.
But Mark, why don't you respond to that, and then I want to get
Of the list of accomplishments, which of them does he argue hasn't happened? I mean, the Dow is up 30%. The economy has expanded. The joblessness, the unemployment rate is 4.1%. Announced this morning, the lowest rate in 17 years.
Lots of
parts of our economy love the fact that this guy is in office and see him as pro-business, pro-growth, And really, this is pro-middle class, because what the middle class has been clamoring for are tax cuts and jobs and the ability to be self-sufficient and live their own lives and live out the American dream, which has been out of reach and out of touch for so many Americans for so long, particularly under the last 8 years under the Obama administration. The economy has been stifled by overregulation, and now we have a man in office who's rolling back regulation, growing the economy, and you know this is a tremendous – and these are tangible benefits, and I don't know where my – friend sees that this
all these trends that Dr. Edney speaks of are things that started and took off during the Obama administration, and there's a continuation of the line. The stock market doubled during the 8 years of no growth that he's speaking about, and now they're taking credit because it's continued on the same trajectory. The same thing is true of the unemployment rate, which went down during the Obama administration. That's continued to go down because of the rebirth of the automobile industry, for instance, that the Republicans were opposed to and that Mr. Obama set in motion. So all of these, I mean, there have been few, if any, gains that were not originally in the direction that was set by the Obama administration.
The Obama administration was actually characterized by an anemic 2% or sub 2% growth for 8 years, the slowest climb out of any depression we've ever had. And now we're looking at 3%, maybe 4% growth. Right.
Let me because we're talking about the economics, because this is interesting. So we had a great recession, the worst recession certainly since the Great Depression, worse than, for instance, even during the Reagan administration, because of the collapse, not only of the stock market, but also real estate. And particularly when you have a financial collapse that you had, particularly on the finance end, and the kind of thing you had, you don't expect to say to come back, even as they did, for instance, during the Reagan years. And there's actually a Federal Reserve component, by the way, to that. So when I hear Republicans say that we've come through this very long period in which we've had some slow growth, that things certainly have adjusted, I expect that to happen in a major recession like that. If I look, for instance, at the unemployment rate, it was dropping like it was no tomorrow. And when you about a year into the Obama administration, you see the decline stop, and then you see it jump back up again, so that you get employment and at a fairly steady rate throughout those 8 years, dealing with the after effects, obviously, of the financial crisis. So the question I have is whether or not it is fair to say, well, this is those 8 years, are they coming out of that recession is simply Obama's fault, or whether or not he was simply dealing with the financial problems that was created actually in the last administration, although I don't necessarily blame George W. Bush for that, whether that's really fair, whether or not what we're really seeing, and I think the thing that Mike would argue is that what he essentially did was lay the basis for what we're now seeing as growth. Because, and by the way, I have not seen, I know there's been a lot of regulations that have been undone, but we haven't seen any great legislative actions that would encourage, would me say, oh, okay, this is going to have an economic impact. Generally speaking, you're talking about a year out before you really see a new administration's policies come forward. I mean,
right.
The reason why I do that is I want to try to put this in a historical context. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, if you Google recovery from recession graph and you look at any graph of recovery of any post-war recession, you look at the dips and then the recoveries. This has been the slowest recovery. And usually the bigger the dip, the quicker the recovery oftentimes. But you look at this has been the absolutely slowest recovery, flattest line recovery from any post-war recession we've had. You can look at the 80s, you can look at the 70s, you look at the 90s, all of the recessions, the dot-com bubble burst, you have a dip, and you have a pretty quick return to baseline.
I guess the question becomes, are those really comparable?
Well, no, what I'm saying is in the context of recession recoveries, this has been much slower than we would have expected because of the stifling regulation of the Obama years and the spending. He added $8 trillion to the federal debt. Okay, you combine national debt and the interest we have to pay on that with stifling regulation out of EPA and out of, that are absolutely smothering industry. Industry is actually what pulls us out of recession. It's expansion, it's jobs, it's putting people back to work. And when you put a rag over the mouth of industry and keep them down through the regulatory process, you see slow slow climbs out of recessions like this. And then all of a sudden we get a new president. Industry says, finally a breath of fresh air. And yeah, now absolutely. In reality, it's going to take a couple, the Reagan tax cuts took 2 or 3 years before we actually started revenue coming back in. They generated more revenue than historically had ever been generated from a tax cut.
Let's be clear about that. We need to get onto the rest of it, but let's be clear about this. The reason why we had a major recession was because the Federal Reserve Board hiked the interest rates. And as soon as inflation was done, they then eased those interest rates. And that's where you then begin to get the takeoff, which is in 82. Okay. So, and as a matter of fact, I've seen a number of folks who were in the Reagan administration on the economic side say it wasn't the tax cuts that we had in 81. It was the Fed. And that's how we got Morning America. And even in 84, 2 years out from the trough in 82, the unemployment rate was still at 7%.
Right.
So there are other dynamics. That's all I'm saying.
I agree. There's lots of moving parts with these things, right. and depending on your political position, you're gonna highlight this or that or the other.
Well, talk about political position. This even my brittle ass thing.
But one point we do know, and I think all economists agree, that virtually all of the gains in the economy that Mark is crowing about were realized by the top 1%. That the middle class is not, in fact, benefited other than through the job creations and whatever that were done during the Obama administration. They've not benefited by, for instance, this tremendous increase in the capitalization. You know, all the money is going to the wealthy. And, and that's what we see is coming from the new tax plan that may or may not be approved in the next 2 weeks before to give Mr. Trump his Christmas present. Mark continues to beat the drum as Republicans always do about the trickle down effect of putting more money back into the economy and that sort of thing. I just saw a study the other day done by the University of Chicago, which is the leading conservative-oriented economic force in the country, saying that 34 out of 35 economists who they polled believe that the new tax plan will not, in fact, increase the benefits to the middle class so much as to the wealthy people who the tax plan seems geared to.
And this is a major difference, and I think a real problem with our rhetoric is that when Democrats say benefits to the rich, what a Republican hears is benefits to the job creators. And because they're talking about one and the same. When they talk about benefits to the rich and the class who have resources and make small businesses, the vast majority of businesses in the United States are small businesses, mom and pop shops who open up shop and create a few employees. And then when they can double, their jobs go from 8 to 16 to 32. That's business creation. That's job creation. It's not the IBMs necessarily or the huge corporations. But whenever there's a benefit to, quote, the rich, that's actually a benefit to the job creators in this country who then expand business, create jobs. When you have more jobs, you create more competition for jobs. Wages have to go up. And that's just how the market works. And so that's economics 101 that Democrats often refuse to acknowledge.
Right. I was just for the record that you can also have too much money on the supply side and it simply bids up other forms of investment.
When government gets involved,
so
right, you get mismatches of supply and demand.
There are two pieces of the equation. There's the demand side and the supply side.
Correct.
I don't think we have a problem with supply, but let's get to okay. let's move. We're going to have a whole economic
none of us are economists, but we can speculate.
Right, exactly.
And we can
right.
pick out little pieces that
exactly.
we read in various places.
I'm going to have to bring a few of them in. Anyway, I want to talk about the polls for just a moment because we've seen that Donald Trump's approval rating, as I mentioned a moment ago, is about 58%. Disapproval at 36% approval. There is some concern, it looks like, in terms of the Russia investigation, which we'll get into a bit later, although that doesn't necessarily seem to be the driving force. One of the interesting things I saw, there was a Pew poll about evangelicals, in which his approval rating dropped from 78% to 61%. It's about 17% drop. So I was looking at historically, where are we, generally speaking at this time? So like Bill Clinton at this time had like a 48% approval rating. Ronald Reagan had 49%. Barack Obama had 50%. Even Jimmy Carter had 56% approval rating. And then, of course, you go up obviously the biggest one was George W. Bush, who had 85%, which was after 9/11. But outside of that, John Kennedy probably had the biggest, which was 78%. So I contrast that. And the reason why I bring up the polls is that one of the powers of the presidency is to persuade people. And when you have poll figures like this, it seems to me that it's going to be very difficult for a president to persuade people. We know, for instance, the tax cut package has a wide disapproval as opposed to approval in terms of public opinion. So how do you assess the president in terms of being able to persuade people? I mean, sometimes it seems like he's sort of going along with the Republican, you know, how the Republicans put together. But does that pose a problem?
If the Democrats have learned anything through the experience of the election in November 2016, I hope it's that they should never don't overestimate their polls and don't underestimate the power of the American people. And, you know, the polls all along had him down. He shouldn't have won. He shouldn't have gotten through that field of 17. He never should have beaten Hillary Clinton if you believe the polls. And so something's missing from the polls that we keep quoting. However, another explanation for the really low public approval rating is he's a populist president, and he's the first populist president we've had in a long time, which means he's not adhering to standard, certainly Democrat orthodoxy, but mainstream Republican orthodoxy. He's sort of outside of that box. And so he's actually ticked off a fair number of people, more Democrats and Republicans, but there's a fair amount of establishment Republicans that just don't agree with the way he's going about his job. And so when you combine all of those folks together, there's a small core who's going to stick by him no matter what. But that largely explains sort of some of his decreased poll numbers. But I tell you what, his message resonated in an enormous way, really in an unprecedented way, with middle America, the group that the Democrat Party has walked away from as it's become more liberal and more elite. The workers in the Midwest who had been struggling to find jobs, who are suffering from a tremendous, you know, opioid crisis, and life has not been good. And they finally had this guy come through, cut through all of the politics and say, I'm going to speak to you. And it resonated, enough for him to win that election. So, yeah, we've got decreased poll numbers, but I tell you what, this guy does not lack for support.
Mike, how do you assess that? I mean, and I guess one of the questions I have, and we'll come back to Mark as well, is are the individual characteristics that we've seen of Donald Trump, with his tweets and so on and so forth, and the fact that he is subject almost on an unprecedented scale to mocking his political ideas, saying that he's not well informed. I mean, there's a character issue that I think comes into play. Is that what's driving this, do you think?
Well, I mean, look, Mark is certainly right in one thing, and that is that we all underestimated the ability of this guy to pull it off, okay? And, I mean, to some extent, you can blame the pollsters. To some extent, you can blame all of us for saying there's no way in the world that we're going to elect somebody who has such a personality and such characteristics and such opinions about a lot of things. And we were all wrong. There's no question we were all wrong. I mean, I see the failure of the Democratic Party in last year's election was pretty much a failure to get a message out. I mean, I think that we were complacent, partly because Hillary Clinton was sort of the heir apparent, and everybody thought she was going to sweep into office, and she was not really that popular with the grassroots. There's no question about it, you know. And partly because we felt that Trump was such an out of the mainstream character that there was no way in the world that, you know. I mean, I cheered the day that Ted Cruz pulled out of the race and ceded the nomination to Trump, because I was more concerned about Cruz than I was about Trump at that point. But I think, I mean, basically, I think the Democratic Party failed, not because it's polarized, but because it was complacent, and because we didn't get out the vote, and because people were not turned on by Hillary Clinton, because frankly, Hillary Clinton didn't have a message that resonated with people. She didn't have a message at all. She just was sort of more of the same, carrying on the mantle of the Obama administration, but didn't inspire people. And therefore, it was very much a get-out-the-vote or a failure to get out the vote, it seems to me, that although we did get 3 million more votes than Mr. Trump did, but we didn't get him in the right.
There's a thing called the Electoral College,
but we didn't get
actually
there's no question. We're living under a system that was created in the late 18th century we can criticize all we want, but it is the constitutional system we have.
Right. And under an electoral college, the problem is the liberal elites have a distribution problem. They need to get out of the Upper East Side of Manhattan and the West Coast and infiltrate some of the rest of the majority of the country that actually has quite conservative values.
Well, or the other thing, you could say we've created a system where Montana's got as many votes as California does in some respects, you know, and that doesn't make a lot of sense
I was remind people there were like three states in which if you just shifted 80,000 votes,
that's right.
Hillary Clinton would be elected. So, I mean, we
she got more votes. So, you know,
that's the electoral
we don't, have to spend time relitigating the politics. But however, I want to get back to something else.
I didn't finish. I mean, but despite the fact that we, you know, that we did not resonate and we did not have a message and we did not get out the vote, we still got 3 million more votes than the Republicans can. And, I mean, I'm very optimistic about the upcoming election because despite some tugging and pulling between various candidates and various segments of the Democratic Party, I mean, there is more energy now in the Democratic Party than there's been for years, you know, perhaps even more. I mean, Obama certainly energized part of the party, but there's all sorts of progressive movements popping up all over the country, you know, and there are more people now that are engaged in Democratic politics than I've seen in probably my lifetime.
Mike touched on something very important in his comments. He started off by saying we didn't get the message out properly. And there's a difference between that and we've got the wrong message. And he finally said Hillary Clinton didn't have a message. We don't have a message. I completely agree with that. And my advice to my Democratic friends is that if you want to have any hope of large-scale electoral success again, you've got to look at your message. It wasn't a communication issue. It's the message. Americans are sick and tired of identity politics, political correctness, and all of this. This is which really forms the foundation of Democratic policy, sort of, you know, going back a long time, but was particularly doubled down on during the Obama years. We're sick of the politics of division. We want to talk about real solutions for real people and how to move this thing forward. And when we're talking about this group versus that group and who's offended, they kill themselves. And if they want to stick with it, I think they're looking forward to many more electoral losses. But if they want to modify that message and try to create a message that resonates with the middle of America the way Donald Trump has, they're welcome to the table and to the debate.
Let me just interject poll and then we'll go to Mike here. There's a Washington Post poll. 2/3 of people in this country say that Donald Trump is dividing the country. That's a poll. Go ahead, and then we'll come back.
And let me say this. You know, I mean, I rightly criticize, I think, the Democratic Party. Let's talk a little bit about the Republican Party. You know, I grew up, Mark may not know this, I grew up as sort of a conservative. I subscribed to National Review in the 1960s.
I grew up a Democrat, too.
Okay.
We did this.
I still subscribe to the National Review, which is the leading conservative magazine. I still have the copy a year ago where they said they had 9 articles, I think, saying how Donald Trump would be an absolute disaster for this country, how he wasn't a conservative, he'll never be a conservative, and the stuff that he was promoting was so far out of the mainstream of the conservative movement. Okay, I would maintain, and I think it's I think that following the news and following the comments and following the way things have gone in the last 6 months, that the Republican Party is not at all united behind Trump. Certainly the Congressional Party is not united behind Trump. I mean, they don't like him at all. They are concerned about whether he can carry the day. I would not be surprised to see a strong conservative opposition, perhaps Cruz or somebody else, coming from the Republican Party. It's almost unheard of to campaign against a sitting president. But I think that the Republican Party is sufficiently concerned about whether Trump can pull it off again, and about a lot of his policies, which are out of the mainstream of good Republican thinking, that there's a strong likelihood that the party won't back him strongly or won't be united behind him in the next presidential election.
I'd say it really depends on how these next couple of years go. I mean, you started off by saying he's had no electoral success. Well, we just passed tax reform. They're going to come to a committee.
We haven't passed tax reform yet.
That'll get done. It'll get done. And then the Senate is going to revisit health care in the spring. So I disagree with the way they went about health care. I think it was on an artificially short timetable. I don't think there was enough debate about it.
Let's talk about the way they did tax reform.
It'll come back, and eventually that'll likely get done, too. If he starts to notch some electoral successes, I don't see anybody running against him in a primary. A lot of them learned their lesson during that original primary. Something's going to have to be fundamentally different for a conservative Republican to sort of want to put themselves out and challenge him in a primary. Some really bad things are going to happen. So far, so good. It really depends how these next 2 years unfold.
I only have one word, Virginia. I mean, there was a situation where not only did the gubernatorial candidate do well on the Democratic side, better than everybody expected, but this huge majority that they had in the House of Delegates, I think it is, just got wiped out. I mean, if they have the control, it's only going to be by a few delegates. Doesn't that harbinger some rethinking about what's the impact of this president and where the Republican Party is going? I mean, the bellwether.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge shock. I mean, Virginia's really been a purple state, and it's really becoming a blue state. With the growth of the suburbs in and around D.C. and people sort of, you know, living their lives off the federal fisc, you create a lot of Democrats just because they're protecting their paychecks. And so,
Virginia really has become
blue. So it wasn't an enormous surprise. We had hopes that Gillespie would pull it out, but it didn't. So I don't think it was a shock.
What about the legislative side of it, though? I mean, because it was one thing to sort of a nation. A statewide thing where, yes, you've got Northern Virginia, which dominates, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you had a lot of unexpected losses and districts, Virginia districts, that perhaps you shouldn't have had.
Yeah, I mean hard to know. A lot of moving parts, a lot of different sort of local influences that we may not be aware of. I think it's really hard to say from an outsider perspective what exactly happened in those races. But there's no doubt about it. Virginia's becoming blue.
Mike, what do you think? Is that a hopeful sign for you guys on the Democratic side, or do you have to be careful not to read too much?
I think all of that is very, very hopeful, you know. And I mean, I'll go back to what I said before, though you know, I mean, Trump is not a conservative, you know, and it seems to me that, I mean, I thought my friend Mark was a conservative, or at least he was a few years ago, but now he's a Trumpian, which, you know, seems to me to violate.
These labels. I haven't heard
the Republicans talk about increasing the deficit or decreasing the deficit, which, you know, used to be the worst thing could possibly happen is to increase the national debt. And now we're on the verge of approving a tax plan, depending on who you believe.
I love that Democrats have just become deficit hikes after a tax bill is going to add $1 trillion to the deficit, which we're going to make back in growth after $8 trillion added during the Obama years. Now the Democrats are coming out of the woodworks and they're deficit hawks.
Wait, hang on, Mark. I've never been a deficit hawk. You know, I mean, I think we should spend money on all the things we need: infrastructure, building up the city, jobs creation, and that sort of thing.
Right.
But no, my point was that the Republicans, who used to be deficit hawks, have said, "Gee, deficit? What's a deficit? We don't know what that is." Gee, $1 trillion, we can absorb that easily enough, you know. Or we're going to not absorb it because we're going to create all these new jobs, which they always say, to get back
to economics, but 3 to 3.5% growth is actually going to eliminate that $1 trillion.
Where's it going to eliminate it? Who's going to do the 3.5% growth?
The expansion of the economy, the expansion of business, and the growth of jobs.
We know that there is a tremendous amount of cash that is being not used today in these major corporations.
And it's starting to come out of the sidelines. That's why the Dow's up 30%.
But the Dow was going up during the Obama administration. Was that because of the...
Up during the Obama administration? Yeah. What was the percentage change over those 8 years?
It doubled. The Dow doubled.
And it's just increased by 30% in less than a year.
But the money's not going into jobs. It's not going into creation jobs, is it?
But I want to ask Mark the statement that Mike made, which is, are you a Trumpian? Have your views shifted? I mean, we obviously free trade is probably like the one that pops out to me because Republicans are always free trade.
That's one area in which I part with Trump. I mean, I disagree with him sort of disassembling the, you know, trade agreements. I think trade agreements are important. I think trade needs to be fair. But I'm not a protectionist at all. I'm a believer in the free market, and I think, you know, our companies here need to compete locally. They need to compete internationally. I think barriers should be reduced, but we should not be protecting one industry over another or creating international barriers to protect our industries. I think our industries can stand on their own 2 feet, and they ought to innovate and fight for themselves. And so, I mean, that's consistent sort of across the board. My personal policy with respect to trade policy and not being protectionist.
So let me ask you, turning to foreign policy, we obviously had just recently the president said that the United States is going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and is going to move the embassy perhaps in 6 months or so. It looks like it. Lots of other presidents, by the way, have promised to do the same thing. There's a law and so on, but everybody sort of waived it because of the peace process. But we've also had, obviously, Trump initially questioned the value of NATO, for example, and so on. How do you see Trump's foreign policy? And, I mean, are there successes to be looked at? I know there's a lot of world leaders that are looking askance.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think his initial tour was, you know, through to, into Saudi Arabia and through the Muslim world was the antithesis of Obama's apology tour. And so I thought it was great. I thought he established partnerships and he sort of reaffirmed that America is a partner to the Middle East, that we want to see sort of peace and everybody getting along. We want to contain Iran, which is the largest state sponsor of terrorism throughout the Middle East, an incredibly destabilizing regime. And so, you know, reaffirming our support with our friends in Saudi Arabia and Jordan, I think was incredibly important. No doubt about it. The issue of moving the embassy to Jerusalem was unpopular amongst these people that we're trying to reassert our friendship with. Personally, I think it's a brilliant political move. It's going to have a lot of short-term costs. But this is a guy, and the reason he was able to do this is because he's a man who doesn't care about political consequences. And I think the reason that the other presidents verbalized it and they talked a good game but never did it, they didn't have the intestinal fortitude from a political standpoint to actually pull the trigger. He does, because ultimately it is the right thing, because Jerusalem's the capital of Israel. And recognizing that, I think, he's resetting a baseline, and it's going to tick people off and there'll be riots and we'll get past this. It's human psychology that we're going to focus on this now, 6 months, a year down the road, we're going to be on to something else. And 2 years down the road, the embassy is going to be there and that's going to be the new baseline. But what that does is it resets the playing field, and it gives the Palestinian side sort of a huge thing in their business. All right. So the embassy's here. We didn't like it, but it's here. Now, how about these settlements? Now, how about these borders? Now they come to the bargaining table with a huge chip saying, all right, we didn't like it, but it's here. So what are you going to do for us now? And I think it resets that table. And there, you know, the White House is working on a draft proposal of a two-state policy that I think is going to be unveiled at some point next year, and we'll see where this all fits in. So, yes, he's going to pay a short-term political price for it, no doubt about it. It was an unpopular move in the Arab world, but I think we'll get past this. That'll be the new normal, and I think it'll be a new effective baseline from which to restart negotiations.
Mike?
Not only was it a popular move, it was a stupid move, and everybody seems to agree that it's a stupid move. There's nobody in the world that agrees with it except for Bibi Netanyahu, who seemed to be overjoyed that Trump has finally moved in that direction. I mean, even Republican foreign policymakers from the last however long have said, why would anybody possibly do this? If nothing else, that was seen as a bargaining chip in the ongoing, never-ending negotiations over the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And guess what? Trump just gave it away. He gave away that bargaining chip. I mean, I've seen more criticism, mostly from Republican foreign policymakers in the last few days, about why would anybody possibly do something like that without asking for anything at all in return. And he's certainly alienated. I mean, he stirred up the Arab world, you know, or the Muslim world again. And it may be a short-term blunder. It may resonate down the road. I don't know. And nobody knows what's going to happen with it. But the thing that got me was Trump seemed surprised that people didn't say this is a wonderful gesture. I mean, he seemed truly not to understand the geopolitics of the whole Arab-Israeli controversy that's been going on for years and years and years. Yeah. Probably because he doesn't read anything and he doesn't listen to anybody except people who say what he wants to hear.
Let me continue with you, Mike, for a moment. So, but stepping back from the Jerusalem decision, how do you assess overall his forays into foreign policy?
Terrible. I mean, he doesn't have anybody.
I mean,
the European nations have all expressed anything from skepticism to rage over what he's been doing. I mean, he has alienated certainly the Brits. The special relationship we've had with Great Britain for the last 30 or 40 years is now at the low point. According to most observers, he and his Secretary of State have pretty much decimated the State Department. Now, Mark may say that's a great thing because we have too many bureaucrats over there. But, I mean, that's how foreign policy is made, and that's how it should be made, and that's how it has been made. And maybe it can all be made by White House tweets, but I don't think so. And it remains to be seen whether, in fact, what we have done, and we've done it through things like the policy on the Pacific trade. We have pretty much abdicated leadership in NATO, leadership in the world, leadership in the Pacific community to other people. And that may be a good thing in the long run in some respects, but it certainly was not consistent with the foreign policy that this country has always adhered to. And, you know, I mean, Mark could talk about, gee, we're standing up to Iran, you know, But we're also permitting Saudi Arabia to bomb the hell out of the. We've created a terrible problem in Yemen, which nobody wants to talk about. You know, the foreign policy in the Middle East is in chaos. Frankly, it's not improved by Trump going over there. You know, he had the Saudis on his side, but now he seems to have alienated the Saudis again with his recent move. So I don't think there's anybody who really looks to the White House as the leader of the free world at this point.
Let me ask you this, because there's this perception, certainly, that the president has an affinity to dictators. That's the sort of line. And they talk to, obviously, Vladimir Putin, Duterte out of the Philippines, Erdogan out of Turkey, and that there is a move away from values-based foreign policy to one of maybe perhaps in zero-sum. How do you make of that? And that's, by the way, I should make it. Should note that that's been a tension, actually, in American foreign policy for a great many years. I mean, Wilson talked about values-based, and then we've talked about realpolitik. So there's always been this kind of tension. What do you make of that perception?
The issue is, you know, foreign policy is nuanced, and he's just not a nuanced man. He's a pragmatist. And so it's not a good match for his personality style to sort of handle the nuances that are foreign policy. I think it's a huge stretch to say he's, quote, becoming friends with dictators. He wants what's best for this country. I honestly, to my core, believe that. He wants what's best for America. And if it's best for America to start dialogue where there hasn't been dialogue before, so be it. He's not friends with Vladimir Putin. I mean, this Russian investigation thing is – I mean, if the Democrats want to continue to spend money and time sort of chasing their tails around this thing, that's great, because we've got an election coming up and they're going to miss the mark again because there's nothing there, and it's been shown that there's nothing there. But they'll keep focusing on that.
We can get to that. But
it's nuanced. And has he handled it sort of in the most diplomatic way? No, he's not a diplomatic guy. And that's just who Trump is. And I understand the frustration on many parts with – you know, the hope that, you know, we could have sort of a more nuanced, sort of internationally politically adept person in the White House. We don't. He's a good guy. He's doing a lot of good things. That may not be one of his strong suits. But again, I think at the end of the day, he's got American interests at heart. And I think he's forming relationships that ultimately are going to benefit our country and our future.
What about the values that we're supposed to represent? I mean, do you think those may be sacrificed for the transaction?
Well, I mean, ask Hillary Clinton about values, taking billions of dollars from Saudi Arabia, where women treated her so horribly. I mean, we talk about sort of values-based, you know, what about the values? I mean, yes, we all have values. And values come into conflict sometimes with the proper function of government, with diplomacy, with trying to raise money for your foundation, if that's what you're trying to do. So values come into conflict in a lot of these things. And I don't think you can – yes, we do have high values, and we want to represent the high mark in sort of in behavior and conduct around the world with our partners. But sometimes a particular line of negotiation sort of, you know, has to let that stand down, and you can't use values as the top line watermark for whether or not we're going to pursue a particular policy or a particular agenda. Yeah, we all care about, you know, keeping a high level with respect to values, but sometimes that quite frankly gets in the way of other needs of the nation and other diplomatic goals.
All right, give Mike just a quick response, particularly with regards to Hillary Clinton, because I mentioned this tension that tends to exist in terms of realpolitik and American values. Do you think that's a legitimate critique of Hillary Clinton's both time in office and certainly the various fundraising activities?
Well, certainly in part it is, you know. I mean, and I could be critical of some of the things of the foundation, although I think that was overblown. The same way that Mark says the Russian thing is overblown. They want to relitigate the last year's election and throw Hillary in jail for doing things. I mean, from everything I could read, the Clinton Foundation did wonderful things in various parts of the world, you know. I certainly can't assess how much of it went into their pockets as opposed to went into other projects. But from what I've read, they did quite a good job as a worldwide foundation, active in many, many countries. And sure, I mean, the people contributed to the foundation because they wanted advantages. I don't think there was any evidence that countries were given advantages or that it parlayed into, distortions in our foreign policy. But I mean, I think you're right, Don, that, you know, that, I mean, at least the government stood for things, and I don't think the government stands for those things now. You know, I mean, and Clinton and Obama both were Maybe they always didn't put their money where their mouth is, or maybe they spoke about things and couldn't always deliver. But I mean, Marcus is criticizing Hillary because of her selling out to Saudi Arabia when Trump has sold out to Saudi Arabia in so many other ways that, you know, I don't think that's something that makes any sense to criticize her for that.
So I want to turn to Mark's favorite subject, which, of course, is the Russia investigation. It's hard to keep up with the developments every night. I got to stay up till 11 o'clock in order to make sure I didn't miss anything.
That's right.
So I'm going to start with Mike Prettl here. So what do you make of the Russia investigation in terms of where it's going? How close do you think it is getting to the president? What's your assessment of that?
Well, in the first place, I think it is it's incredible to me how the Republican Party and the Republican leadership in the Congress now seems to feel that their strongest line of attack should be to attack the FBI. Apparently, they went through a hearing the other day where they just crucified the FBI and accused them of selling out and being a wing of the Democratic Party and that sort of thing, which is really incredible since, historically, they've always been, the FBI has always been considered to be the conservative arm of the Justice Department, if you will, and under J. Edgar Hoover and even following Hoover. They also were all in with Mueller until he started to get close to the White House and started to come up with some results. And now they seem to want to call him a sellout and a closet Democrat and a arm of the Democratic Party. But I don't know what they're going to find. I think reading a lot of the complexity of it, there is a real question about what is collusion and whether collusion is illegal and that sort of thing. It seems to me, as a number of people have commented, the strongest evidence is the extent to which the Republicans and the White House leadership and the campaign leadership have lied blatantly about contacts with the Russians, which makes you feel that there must be something buried there that they don't want to come out. So I don't know what's going to come out, it does bother me. I mean, certainly there are at least a dozen instances of contacts between the Russians and the Trump campaign and now the Trump administration that have been deliberately obfuscated or concealed, and it's all coming out now. And I think it's real. I disagree with my friend Dr. Edney that it's just a game that the Democrats are playing. If it is, if they don't come up with anything, then it's going to be a major loss for the anti-Trump forces, I guess. But I think most of us are I'd say optimistic because it's not something that we want to happen. But right. I think it's likely that there is going to be some additional blood drawn, some additional indictments, and it may go as high as the president himself.
Michael Flynn and George Papadopoulos, they have plea deals now. Paul Manafort, who was the former campaign manager along with the deputy, Rick Gates, they're now being charged with crimes, which are not necessarily related directly to the campaign. We've got emails now pulling in Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner. We even have an indication from Donald Trump Jr., I believe, some conversation might have taken place in terms of the president who was then the candidate and this infamous June meeting. The thing that strikes me at is, as I've tried to sort of piece this thing together, initially it looked as if to me that the Russians were kind of poking around the campaign, trying to, get a little meeting with Jeff Sessions or something, right? That sort of thing.
Which they've done for years, by the way.
But as more and more comes out in terms of the intent, at least, of some of the folks on the Trump side, it seems to become even more and more entwined. I mean, I don't know what we're going to find. I don't know whether this is just a gang that can't shoot straight. It could be. But there seems to be a lot more involvement than maybe even I certainly first believed. That there's something odd going on. I mean, maybe that's
it. It certainly seems to be unending. And so you've got Flynn who's been indicted. Why was he indicted? He was indicted for lying. What was he lying about? He wasn't lying about any smoking gun. He was lying about something stupid about the timing of a sort of a communication, whether or not a communication happened. He lied to the vice president. That's and you lied to the FBI. That's an indictable offense. And so he's indicted. But you know, so Democrats jump up and down. We finally indicted somebody, but there's nothing there.
Why did he lie?
Well, I'm going to tell you why.
The nation is waiting.
Here's my theory.
Go ahead.
If Democrats haven't paid attention, one of the plays out of Donald Trump's book is to dangle bright shiny objects for his opponents, get them chasing their tails while he gets stuff done over here. Mm-hmm. He did it through the campaign, and I think he's doing that to the Democratic establishment right now. I think they're slow playing this. I think it's a slow trickle. They're being obstructionist and they're letting some things go. There'll be some indictments here. There'll be some indictments there. There will be no smoking gun, but he will have the Democratic establishment chasing their tails for the next 2 years while we win elections in 2018 and 2020 while they have their eye off the ball. I honestly think that that's a very good – he's a smart man. I think you underestimate him if you just think he's a sort of this New York sort of billionaire out of touch sort of – doofus. I mean, he's a very, very smart man. And I think strategic. I mean, he got through that field of 17 when nobody said he would. He's got strategy. He knows what he's doing. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a larger strategy here to sort of keep the Democratic establishment busy, chasing, chasing indictments and FBI and whatever, slow play that whole process while he goes about the business of expanding the economy, protecting the borders, building the military, and getting done what needs to be done for the American people.
So, Mike, you being distracted by the shiny thing?
Obviously, yes, right?
I mean, now, how many of his cabinet officers have been either thrown out or resigned or indicted, or I mean, his administration is falling apart. You know, are we going to have, who's going to be Secretary of State next week? You know, is that a shiny object that we're dangling? First, they say they're going. His people put out the word that we're going to change, and Pompeo is now going to be the new Secretary of State. And then Trump the next day says, "Oh no, that's not the case. Is that all a game that he's playing with the American public?"
He's got a vision, you know. Administrations evolve, you know, and people come and go. And yeah, there's been a high rate of turnover, probably higher than historically.
I think the number I saw was a dozen people have left the White House or the administration in some fashion. Or another.
Absolutely,
the high one, you know,
right?
Almost,
and it's such an.
But is that the game that he's playing? He deliberately is telling people that we're going to change the Secretary of State. He's going to be fired. Okay, we're going to replace it with Pompeo. On Tuesday, on Wednesday, he said, Trump says, "Oh no, he's solid. We've got him." Is that a game they're playing with the American public? Is that democracy?
Who knows?
It may be
an effective, bright, shiny object. Is what it may be.
You seem to be saying this is wonderful. This is the way we should conduct democracy.
I'm just saying
keep them guessing.
That's been his strategy, and it seems to be working.
But you seem to say it's not only his strategy. You seem to say it's great. It's the way that we should run our government. We should tell people things that aren't true.
I am not espousing this is the way to sort of conduct your administration.
It seems to
be
the most
amoral.
Politics. I mean, real politics usually takes place across the with other nations. Now you're saying he's playing games with the American public, and he's keeping them dazzled with all sorts of things that he knows aren't true, just to keep them off balance, so that he can carry out his true
agenda. Man's a pragmatist.
Again, let's go back to the tax bill. He doesn't even know what's in it. He doesn't care much about substance.
Well, we knew what was in the Obamacare when it passed. We knew exactly what was in it.
There's 140 hearings they had on the Obama pair over 18
months. Nancy Pelosi said you got to pass it before you know what's in it. It's not fair to level that against this particular month.
How many hearings were there on the tax bill? None. I mean, it's incredible that you have a tax bill that is this comprehensive, that you don't have any public hearings at all. I mean, it just boggles the mind.
Do I take it that a president, Edley, would not do this? His approach would be different than
It's a hard hypothetical.
But all the things that the Republicans, especially the conservative Republicans, the intelligent conservative Republicans, if I could be so bold, were criticizing Trump for a year ago. Now they're saying, hey, look, you know, we still don't like him, but he's going to get the job done, and he's going to give us the goodies that we want. He's going to put money back in the pockets of the rich, so let's go along with his game plan. I mean, it seems to me it's from my perspective, a completely amoral way to approach governance. What do I know?
As a matter of fact, what do we know? The term fake news has now become the meme of the last couple of years, and has clearly moved away from its moorings, which was, as I said, people just would make stuff up. We, of course, the president attacking the press, but particularly using this phrase. And oftentimes you'll hear things from, for instance, the podium at the White House, which don't seem to be true. We had to see it now with this incident where the president tweeted these anti-Muslim videos, and one of which was clearly demonstrably not true. And the White House basically said, well, we don't know whether it's the issue that counts. It's not whether or not this was really valid. Mark, to you, is that, I mean, are we suffering somewhere here along the line in terms of trying to discern, as in the general public, that perhaps we will not be able to discern what's true and what isn't, that we're being hoodwinked here? I mean, doesn't fact matter? I mean,
of course facts matter. Yeah. And I think it's harder and harder for the American people. It's harder for everyone to really discern and cut through all the garbage to find out what is fact, because so many news outlets, whether they're mainstream media, which are heavily biased in favor of the liberal democratic establishment, whether, you know, where they're sourcing their facts and putting a spin. I mean, everything you read now is almost an editorial page. It's really hard to get unfiltered news and facts. On both sides. I mean, there are conservative news outlets where you get a very sort of conservative bent. And I will see, you know, Fox News leans to the right. You know, CNN, MSNBC lean to the left. Their news reporting has really become largely opinion on the left or the right. And so when we say fake news, I think that's just sort of an expression of the frustration of it. It used to be fairly easy to get sort of run-of-the-mill news at 6 o'clock at night. You could tune in to your news anchor and at least get a straight reporting of what happened and then make up your own mind. And if you wanted to turn to an opinion page, you can turn to an opinion page. Everything seems to be filtered through the opinion of one angle or another. So it's very hard for people to know where to turn for real information and what's real and what's not. And we all come to this collection of news with our own personal biases. We have selection bias, and we tend to consume those news outlets that support our opinion. We tend to stay away from those that don't. And I think that just it creates a problem for our democracy. It really does, because it's hard to know where the truth really lies, because it's usually somewhere in the middle.
And then I'm going to get to Mike, because the thing that really struck me about the videos is the sort of sense from the White House spokesperson that the fact that it wasn't factual just didn't matter. Isn't that problematic?
I have a problem with that.
Information
coming out of sort of, you know, whether it's the White House or sort of any government agency, hope that they're not putting out information that they know to be factually wrong.
And that
bleeds slowly into sort of, you know, partisan manipulation of data to try to sway opinion. I'm not saying that's what this was.
Right.
But where's the line there? Because there is a line. But I think that line has been crossed so often that now we've gone way too far into, let's not even twist what is reality into our favor, but let's actually put out false information. I think it's a dangerous precedent.
Well, I agree and disagree with what Mark is saying. But when he says it's hard to find the facts now, I think that is absolutely wrong. There is so much information out there. The problem is that there is so much information that's available that you can always find. Excuse me?
It's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. Okay, but it permits people to distort things. So, I mean, you know, again, my field is the thing that I've focused most on the last year is the environment, you know. I mean, there's an incredible amount of data with respect to climate change. I mean, every university in the world has people working on climate change. There are literally 100,000 climate scientists today. And the overwhelming consensus on more than practically anything in the history of science is that climate change is a serious, serious problem caused by human activity. But the people who have an economic interest in fossil fuels and in continuing things the way they have been always in the past can find just a few little facts here and there that can distort the dialogue. So the problem isn't that you can't find the truth. The fact is that people can spend a lot of time and money to distort the truth and to bias things in their favor, or at least to obfuscate, and that create this whole idea of doubt about whether or not certain facts are true. And the White House has become a wonderful source of one wonderful vehicle for doing that. And that has been their whole game plan, if you will, to say we're not going to worry about what the facts are because we can always find a fact somewhere. We can find these videos to show that all Muslims are brigands and put that out there and at least create the impression in the minds of the gullible that gee, maybe they know something that we don't know. Maybe the mainstream media, so-called, is out of touch with reality, and that these small facts that you know, that we can produce should change the equation, or should be the fact of the day as far as the White House is concerned.
I mean, one of the things that struck me and is that, and something that you said, but I've thought about this for a while, is if everything becomes opinion, then there are no facts. And I certainly disagree in the sense that I do think there is some real good solid straight reporting, particularly from CNN, but from others as well. But the problem of sort of viewing the world that way is that if everything is opinion, then you can choose whatever particular opinion you want, which may or may not have actual facts in it. And so, therefore, we don't have a common frame, a common ground to say, okay, we can disagree about an approach, say, for instance, whether it's the national debt or it's deficit spending or whether we should spend more on the military or not. If we have a set of facts, then we can argue about them. What I think you're suggesting, Mark, is that that's gone, that we don't have that common ground anymore.
You seem to be saying that's a good thing, that we have facts.
Well, I don't know whether it's – but I don't know. I'm not sure he said that was a good thing. Well,
no, I'm not saying it's a good thing.
No, right.
I said the president is a master in doing those sorts of things.
I said it's harmful for our democracy to not have sort of a reliable source of straight information. I agree. I think it's out there. I'm not saying it's gone. It's out there. It's just harder and harder to find. Now, when you say CNN does a lot of straight reporting, I would also say that Fox News does a lot of straight reporting.
There are straight
There are straight reporters at Fox News too. So yes, they exist, but a lot of, and it really depends on what they're talking about. When we get into sort of the political arena and sort of what's going on in Washington, D.C. and policy, I think it very quickly starts to slant sort of in political directions. But there still is straight reporting out there, no doubt about it.
My concern is that view of the particularly the mainstream media, that because if you discredit it, therefore it doesn't matter anymore whether or not what they've told you is true, you may not believe it.
Well, that's a problem. I continue to have a subscription to the Washington Post. It's been it's been a phenomenal newspaper for many, many years. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, going back even 5-6 years ago, I could get my way through the Washington Post and say, oh, that was a good article, and that seemed pretty straightforward. The whole thing's an opinion piece now, and I, to the point where I'm considering canceling my subscription to the Washington Post. I like the newspaper. Historically, I've liked it. But again, I think it's bent a certain way. Mm-hmm. And that's I mourn the loss of just straighter – down the line reporting. There's time for opinion. There's plenty of time. You go to the opinion page if you want to sort of hear things that comport with your view. But I mourn the slow loss of straight reporting. I think we're losing it, and I don't think it's a good thing.
I think the reason that you feel that way is because our politics have been bent to some extent by an administration that is so out of touch with both the mainstream of both parties, you know, and is creating their own sets of facts. To the point that the consensus facts, which is what the Washington Post, I think, pretty much has promoted for years, is now discredited by this administration, because this administration picks and chooses the facts that he wants to believe in, and he wants to tell the public is the truth, and the facts no longer count for anything. So I think their opinions are the truth, and if that's opinion, then.
Yeah, but that is opinion, and I think this migration happened well before the current administration. I mean, it was certainly during the Obama administration, but probably before. And I can't pinpoint exactly when it happened. I think it's been a slow transition, but certainly during the Obama administration. I mean, it's why, particularly with folks on our side. I don't know if you can get any Democrat to admit it, but the mainstream media is largely, you know, left of center, and has a left of center bias to a lot of what it's reporting. That's the way the vast majority of conservatives feel. And I don't you may not get one Democrat or liberal to believe that, because, you know, to take an accusation that things are biased in your favor, you're likely to say, no, it's not. That's just reality, because that's the way things are. But, I mean, that's your worldview. You see the world through those glasses. So if things are biased in your favor, you're going to say, no, it's not biased. That's actually reality. And so that's what he's doing. And I understand why he's doing it. But how do you get to an objective middle?
You've brought up immigration several times. Okay. Mm-hmm. The administration would like us to believe that the southern border is so open that people are swarming in. They're all
it's better than it was now.
Obama deported more people than anybody in history. Is that the fact?
Detainees at the border have gone up 25-30% during the the current administration compared to the Obama administration,
yeah.
the number of detainees has gone way up, meaning these are people who before were getting through and not being detained.
And they were all these criminals and brigands and rapists. And
I can see where this is going. I'm going to have to cut it off here. Yeah, to say the least here. I appreciate, by the way, we've had Mark Edley. He's with the Wicomico County Republican Central Committee. And also Mike Prettle, he's with the Democratic Club. No doubt we'll go ahead and do this again. But I appreciate both of you getting here and having some real strong opinions. Thanks for stopping by. Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.